Müller House Meeting, Sunday afternoon, 6th April 1975.
This morning, we considered some deep and important aspects of crucifixion, resurrection and ascension. This has its correspondence presented, of course, not in a matter-of-fact dramatic form, but in a deeply mystical as well as metaphysical form in the teaching of what is called the Purusha Medha. Medha is the sacrifice, Purusha of the person. In the Christian presentation, Jesus, the sinless one, lays down his life on the cross. The body is completely sacrificed. We must understand the transcendent significance of this sacrifice of the body. We usually regard sacrifice as something which is offered up in the form of the destruction of an object or an animal or a body, living body. But consider carefully the deep meaning of the word sacrifice. The Latin facio sacere feci factum, which means I make, and sacrum, sacred. To sacrifice is to make sacred. In other words, there is sanctification. You remember the wonderful prayer of communion in St. John's Gospel, in the 17th chapter, 16th and 17th chapters. Now he was supposed to pray there to the Father in secret, in private. Who heard him? No other person was there. He never wrote it down. But the disciple, St. John, knew by direct transmission that which his Lord and Master had taught him. He could enter a state of consciousness which reenacted this which Jesus expressed in that final prayer. And he says, now I am no longer in the world, and I come to thee. And he goes on, now glorify thou me with thine own self, with the glory which I had before the world was. This world does not refer to the planet, the earth. The word world in the scriptures fundamentally and in the first instance refer to the body itself, the living organism. This is my world. And in that state of communion, where transcendence itself is completely at one with the perfected consciousness of the Holy One, the word I refers to that. And therefore, in saying, glorify thou me with the glory I had with thee before the world was, it simply means that transcendence functioning in the Holy One completely sanctifies the entire body. This sanctification produces a transfiguration of the whole body. This is not mentioned in St. John's Gospel, but the other transfiguration, which was seen previously by Peter and two other disciples, that transfiguration is mentioned. This transfiguration takes place when there is the moment of enlightenment or unification with the Supreme, and it also takes place towards the end of the life of the Holy One. In the case of the Buddha, for instance, that transfiguration which takes place, which his beloved disciple, again, it's the beloved disciple, sees, Ananda sees, the body of the Buddha utterly golden in color and radiating light. And the Buddha explains how this transfiguration takes place at the time of enlightenment and before the passing away of the body. So the body is sanctified. And this is what Jesus refers to. Then comes the final laying down of the body and the utter and complete passing away. But remember the last words which are in St. John's Gospel. The last words are not Eloi, Eloi, lama sabachthani, my God, why hast thou forsaken me? And I tried to explain what Eloi actually means. This unified nefesh, the vital principle, which therefore is closest to bodily existence, ruah, the intellectual principle, buddhi as we call it in India, which sees with unerring insight the truth of things. That is the real meaning of buddhi. And the neshama, which is transcendence itself embodied in the disciple. Shiva, at home in his own kingdom within the body of the purified one. So the last words are not Eloi, Eloi, lama sabachthani in St. John's Gospel, that on the cross it is finished. The word finished meaning not ended, not death, destruction, breaking up. Finished in the sense of the craftsman saying that the what he has produced is the finished product, the perfected product. The great mission of Jesus was completed, perfectly completed. It is finished, he said. These are the words ascribed to him. Now this, the final relinquishment of all grasping after manifested existence, the complete renunciation and relinquishment of the person Jesus as such. This is the real equivalent of what we have in the Upanishadic teachings, the Purusha Medha, the sacrifice of the person, the making sacred of the person. Now this is something which mere scholarship cannot possibly see, cannot be revealed by mere intellectual logical processes. One has to experience reality, this sort of deep reality, in some form or other. And then one has to have that inner vision opened up, which enables one to know that this sacrifice of the person is not the taking of a person and slaying him or burning him on the altar or something like that. This is the deep and true meaning of the Purusha Medha. It's the sanctification process. Now this becomes possible only if there is utter purity in the individual. Now you know how often I have spoken of the necessity for perfect stillness, perfect silence, and the complete emptiness of the mind. Let us look, in order that this may happen, let us look a little bit into the meaning and significance of this emptiness of the mind. We must not imagine that the person's mind becomes vacuous, or that the mind is deranged or destroyed. He doesn't become an idiot, empty-minded, or anything like that. Far from it. But it means that every single fixation of the mind is out now. The person is totally released from every single fixation. This is extremely difficult actually to see for oneself. One may read or hear the words, and our own mind sets up an image to try and to correspond to what the words are supposed to represent. But the reality is a stupendous thing altogether. Why? From infancy onwards, the naming process for all our experience, for all objects, for all feelings and thoughts and so forth begins. Now this naming process identifies the appearance and the qualities of our experience. There is a collection of mental images forms in the mind and permeates and controls and directs all the perceptual activities of the mind. Therefore, what happens is that as the next experience comes along, as the next sense impression comes along, it is named by means of these concepts, these fixed images. It is named by them, and it adds to the particular imaginative forms which one's own mind has already made in relation to things, persons, ideas, and experience. So the fixations in the mind, the set forms, become in greater in number and more fixed, generally speaking. It is this fixed nature which makes the mind opaque, makes it like a solid block, an obstruction to true light. The reason is that with every experience or every sense impression which comes, the mind does not see the thing in itself, but sees the image it has made. The mind works imaginatively. That is to say, in terms of making images. Just like, say, in a police station, there are records of people who have done wrong, the descriptive records, and pictures of the person. These are the images by means of which the actual person is identified afterwards. See? Something like that. It's a poor simile and a rather unhappy simile, but perhaps it will do for the moment. So these images in the mind act in that way. And we, being ignorant of the fact that it is the image-making side of the mind which is in action, mistake the images for truth, for reality. This is what always happens. Up to a point, the images will correspond with reality. They must of necessity up to a point correspond, otherwise we would not be able to recognize a table when we see the table again, and recognize which table it is. Is it the dining table or the writing table or what table, and so forth. So up to a point these images correspond to reality. But the individual, in the depths of his consciousness, is deceived into believing that what he sees and the manner in which he sees it or hears or touches it and so on is the fact of the matter, the truth of the matter. Now, why is this a deception? It is not a deception to any serious degree on its own plane of sense percepts, which inevitably give rise to images in the mind. But our sense percepts are extremely limited in nature. They are circumscribed to a very great degree. Now, the proof of that is offered by the knowledge that modern science gives us. Science, in investigating matter, going deeply into the nature of matter, found it necessary to invent instruments which extend our senses. Take for as a simple example the telescope and the microscope. The microscope, because it magnifies things to such an extent, shows us that what we see as a skin appears more and more different the more powerful the magnification of the microscope. It reveals a totally new world. And when we come to the stage where we use electron microscopes and interpret the photographs which we make and so forth, and we look into the structure of the atom as such in itself, and make further experiments which reveal the world within the atom, the subatomic world as we call it, we find this extraordinary fact. that which we thought was solid matter is largely empty space, and only infinitesimally can you use the word particle in relation to it. For instance, the nucleus of an atom has a diameter which is only 1/100,000th or 200,000th part of the distance between that nucleus and the nearest electron. So you see, this vast emptiness gets revealed as the reality of things. But what is our sense experience? Emptiness, you say? I wish it was empty. I bumped my head against the wall and it was far from empty. Nearly cracked my skull upon it. You see? So science has come in to show us that our sense impressions go only so far, and that far is a very little far. That the reality of things is something quite beyond our present imaginative capacity, image-making capacity, which is totally dependent upon the functioning of the senses. Now this has to be borne in mind carefully, that as far as human beings have been able to go, either through the way of meditation and opening up the wonderful dormant possibilities within the mind itself on its own plane, as well as by the method of science, emptiness is perhaps a dominating feature. There is nothing there. No particle, no solid, nothing hard, nothing which resists. But the extraordinary part is this. This nothing is not nothing in the sense in which we use that word when somebody asks us, oh, what's inside that box? And you take off the lid, and you say, oh, there's nothing in it here. No solid physical object. This nothing is no thing. But in saying it is no thing, which is perfectly true in the ordinary way, we do not mean that there is an absolute vacuum there. It is full of energies and forces at play. The entire universe is full of these energies and forces at play. And it is full of them. Transcendent energies, quite beyond our sense perception. And yet, in a mysterious way, to a certain degree at least, experienceable by us in the deep states of consciousness. That is how and why, as far back as 3,000 and 4,000 years ago, the old mystics and holy men declared that this world was as nothing, no thing, but one extraordinary transcendent energy in action. So our mind, in the ordinary way, becomes filled with what we may comparatively and quite justifiably call things. But you know that a thing, for instance, in the physical world, a solid thing, prevents light from passing through it. It isn't transparent to light. All these things in the mind, the collection of our mental constructs, our mental images, and particularly beliefs, conceptions, ideas, and so forth. They are the things that obstruct the light of transcendence. So it becomes imperative in the discipline of the religious life to see that there is the dissolution of these things, which means that the things are not destroyed. Do remember, there is no such thing as destruction in the sense of annihilation anywhere in the universe. These things are seen with greater and greater clarity of mind till you see the no thing. The external shape of all concepts, of all beliefs, completely disappears. The obstruction is gone. And then you are conscious of that thing, of that which you are attending to by being it. You become that thing. This is one of the meanings given of samadhi in one of the yoga Upanishads. Says straightforwardly just what it is. The distinction between the meditator and the meditated, the distinction in other words between subject and object, vanishes. And there is only this all-embracing, single, unitary, whole awareness, which of course becomes indescribable, because then we have no sort of set forms, limited forms of thought or words to make a pattern, a limited pattern of thought and word, which we can hand over to another person. Now this is about as clearly as I can explain the almost inexplicable in words. When this happens, you are conscious in the mode of complete unity of everything. This is the transcendent mode of awareness possible to man. And it is because of this that man woke up at least 6,000 years ago to the nature of holiness, of the awesome, the numinous quality, Rudolf Otto's term, numinous, to the numinous quality of transcendence, God, Brahman, Atma, use what word you like. So you see that as far as the realization of this ultimate state of communion is concerned, one of the most important things in the religious discipline, whatever your religion may be, whatever your religious method may be, one of the most important things is this process of the denudation of the mind. The mind is denuded, made nude, made completely naked, completely empty, so that no concept, no idea is a fixed thing there which prevents that unification in the innermost depths of consciousness of subject, the subject that is oneself, and the object that is whatever is outside. Now, I have talked about concepts, ideas, beliefs being obstructions. There is another great obstruction. The accumulated impressions upon me from the time I am born, as I grow up towards adulthood through the years. There's an accumulation of impressions, the mental impressions, and particularly the unworked out part of those mental impressions. Consider for a moment how we go through an experience. We never go through it completely and fully. We go through it partially. We don't live through it so completely that the experience is gone forever from us. Gone forever. For one thing, attention wanders, the mind wanders as we are going through a particular experience. We don't pay full attention to it. We are not capable of paying full attention to it. The result is that that experience is not fully and completely worked out. There is an unworked out residue which sinks into the well of the personal unconscious part of the mind. Let us take a simple concrete example. I am talking with somebody, and as the conversation proceeds, he says things which annoy me or make me feel, oh, what a fool he is, or perhaps make me feel, oh, what a wonderful person he is. But I never pay that kind of total attention which enables me to see that folly in its completeness, or see that wonder in its completeness, and respond to it in completeness. Therefore, there is a residue, an unfinished portion. Or if you like another simile, like a man in an office who has a whole pile of letters which have arrived that morning, which he has to deal with, and he says, oh, well, I'll deal with this, that, and the other, and leave the rest. But he's got to deal with it later on, hasn't he? Now, this is what happens with our experiences and impressions, the mental impressions. There is so much left over to deal with later on. But, unlike the physical analogies, what happens with these, what with this unworked out portion, which sinks into the well of the unconscious, it constipates the mind. It makes the mind ill. It is the source of dis-ease, the absence of perfect ease, the absence of perfect health of the mind. Anxiety, worry, sorrow, fear, all sorts of things rise up and are associated with it in consequence. So, these unworked out impressions, to use the Sanskrit word, the vasanas, they are all there waiting to be worked out. The good vasanas, as we call them, the fine impulses and the aspirations and what we commonly call good deeds in the ordinary ambivalent sense, they are helpful. They can be helpful. But although they are helpful in the sphere of duality, in the sphere of mortality, they are an obstruction where transcendence is concerned. Because my good as well as my ill is not the absolute good, the absolute virtue of transcendence itself. So I mustn't cling to my good, but I do cling to it, because I'm egoistic and because I'm vain. So you see, all these things accumulate in the mind, in the well of the unconscious, the personal unconscious. And they all have to be worked out. Now, you can't take them one by one and deal with them. It's quite impossible. There are too many millions of these unworked out impressions within the mind, obstructing the light of transcendence, making one's own mind ill at ease, diseased. Constipated is about the best word to use in this connection. You see, you can't work them out like that. But this is where we find, we discover a most marvelous meaning of terms like the mercy and the grace of God, or transcendence, or whatever you like. Grace, prasada, as the Hindus would say. You see, it's the Sanskrit word. And the doctrine of grace comes out in forms of Buddhism other than the Theravada. I don't think the Theravada presentation of Buddhism introduces the idea of grace at all. But grace is a reality. Now, how does this grace function? If I myself begin to see something of what happens in my own mind, and I look at this vast mountain of ill inside me, my first reaction is I'm absolutely terrified. Some of you, if not all of you, know that series of pictures, the Zen pictures, the ox herding pictures, when the distorted man of the world turns to reality, to discover the reality, he sees it as a great big bull, a terrific bull, black bull, and his tail is up in the air, and he sees only the back of the bull and not his face, and he's utterly terrified. But the way is this. You start being mindful. We talked about mindfulness yesterday. You start being mindful. And if you really care and are serious, then that mindfulness becomes more and more intense and effective. You take the immediate living experience, that is the best way to deal with it, instead of attempting to look back in the past. This is my own feeling about it, that it is the best way to take the immediate living experience. You see? And be as mindful as possible of it. Now, in this growing intensity of mindfulness, this intensity of attention, chit is the word, which is not just consciousness, but consciousness in action, consciousness being conscious as such. If this increases, grows in intensity, there comes up this great fire of the spirit. It becomes a heat. A tremendous heat which transforms the dross and purifies the pure metal and releases everything in its purity. And because of the complete attentiveness, there is nothing left over ultimately. At first, of course, there is a lot left over. But as one lives that way and pays complete attention, there is nothing left over. Now, in that process of getting hotted up through the intensity of attentiveness, things out of this well of the unconscious are drawn up into that fire. You see? This is why when you seriously practice living the religious life, you find greater and greater difficulties come up. And you say, why should I, who am striving to the good life, suffer far more than the bad man who is enjoying life, as we say? But this is how it happens. There's no getting away from it. Take up thy cross and follow me. You see? So, all this accumulated, forgotten lumber, and it is as large as the world in each of our single minds, as it comes up, then it sets up the conflict. It drags you back, it tempts you, it frightens you and does all sorts of things to you. But be completely attentive to the immediate moment, and all that dross will get transformed into the pure thing. It slowly gets transformed. Consider Moses and the burning bush. This is the burning bush. And what comes out of the burning bush? The voice of the Lord. The voice of transcendence. Which means that transcendence embodied in your own innermost being comes to light within yourself with that intensity. This is the great meaning of tapas, of the god Agni. We touched upon it the other day also, you remember. Now, what is happening then, as far as one's own mind is concerned? It is becoming emptied of all these fixations, these solidified images which prevent consciousness from being aware of the nature of things in their own real nature. Now, don't run away with the idea that if you practice this, you will gain encyclopedic knowledge of each and everything in the world. You never will. That is a totally mistaken interpretation of omniscience. The perfected Holy One will most probably not be able to pass a simple examination which a bright schoolboy will pass. He hasn't got that kind of brain. It's not that kind of perception, that kind of knowledge. It is this extraordinary faculty of intelligence, pure intelligence, which in the immediate moment, contacting the thing, the person, the object, the situation, understands it inside out at once and knows how to respond to it in the right way. Why? Because there is no separate subject, a man with his limited mind and his particular ideas and so forth, reacting back to the person or the situation. But transcendence itself, utterly free, utterly pure, in terms of its infinity, at the level of its own immeasurable nature, does all the work. And the measurable can never stand up against the immeasurable. Therefore, the immeasurable takes this into its own being and utterly changes it. And this is how, when the Holy One is present, He knows you at once. He knows your human nature. Now note carefully, His knowledge will also be expressed in His brain and in His words in a way similar to the manner in which you or I would talk of a man whom we knew, as we say. Let us assume we do see him. We do understand and know him when we see him. Why is this so? Because when that inner awareness is brought within the limited field of conceptuality and verbal formulation, the material which we can use to form particular conceptions and use particular words is determined by the limited concepts that are already available for communication between man and man. That is why. But in his inner being, in his inner consciousness, the perfected Holy One is so aware of the reality of the other person that he can never harm that person, but His very presence is a power that transforms that person and makes him, brings him closer and closer to his own fulfillment. You know how we say that, oh, such and such a person has a healing influence upon me. What do we mean by this healing influence? It's not as if I had a pimple on my nose and the presence of the Holy One got rid of the pimple on my nose. That is absurd. Not healing in that way. It integrates me, integrates all the analyzed constituents of my being. Body, emotions, thoughts, feelings, and so on and so on. Integrates them more and more. That is the liberating process which is completely indescribable. That is why the presence of the Holy One is a blessing. Sometimes it can be a blasting. If the time and circumstance is ripe, if your web of destiny, the light of your soul, is ready to receive the shock, you go through a traumatic experience because of the benediction of the presence of the Holy One. Give you a simple example, St. Paul at Damascus. He suddenly fell unconscious. This thing happens. We have hundreds of such statements with respect to masters and disciples in India. To give you one living example, assuming that it is a true statement, when Ramakrishna, the founder of the Ramakrishna Vedanta order, you see, when Ramakrishna in the last century met the young man who afterwards was called Vivekananda, Ramakrishna saw that here is something imprisoned which can be unlocked just like that. And he touched him with his toe. And the boy, he was just a boy, he went completely into a very deep state of consciousness. In fact, in that case, probably it was a trance, not a true entry into a conscious entry into a deep state of consciousness. He went into that state. And when he came out of it, he was completely different. He was a transformed being. And he, this boy, who was afterwards called Vivekananda, was the instrument through which the whole Ramakrishna order was founded and organized and spread over the world. So you see, he had a traumatic experience, just as St. Paul had a traumatic experience. So sometimes the influence seems to be a blasting influence at first. But afterwards, the wholeness comes into being. Now, once again, the denudation of the mind, the emptying of the mind. Relate this to the Buddha's teaching. We talked about it this morning. Freedom from all grasping is deathlessness, is immortality. Ideas, thoughts come, they go. They are inevitably thrown out by the activity of the living creative mind. That you cannot avoid. The Holy One also goes through that. But he clings to nothing. Now, if we have been able to attend to this intensely, you may actually experience this emptiness of the mind and simultaneously you will experience the utter fullness of the mind. The emptiness, because things are out, means that the fullness, the plenitude, with all its transcendent power of the no-thing is present now. That no-thing, that creative power, is embodied, is locked up in every single cell of the body itself. Is locked up there. And that power is liberated. You see now why artists of genius have represented the Holy One with a halo round his head. And sometimes his whole body is painted as emanating light. There is reality in this. Consider the extent of this power which is locked up. An energy which is perhaps even more subtle and powerful than the most subtle and powerful energy science knows, electricity. The body is averagely, the human body is averagely composed of 10 to the power 28 atoms. That is one with 28 noughts after it. So many atoms. And in our own lifetime, we know what the power of the atom can be if it is harnessed in certain ways. It can be most terribly destructive. It could wipe out the human race, in fact, if it was misused. Or, if it is rightly used, it can produce an inexhaustible source of energy, fuel. The body has 10 to the power 28 atoms in it. If and when there is this complete denudation of the mind, if there is this utter purity, the whole well of the unconscious is no longer a well of the unconscious, but complete awareness, total awareness permeates the entire organism, then what can this power not do for good? Because it is unhindered now in its action. We may ask, well, why is it then that although there are holy ones, perfected holy ones, reputed to be living in the world today, as they are indeed, and as they always have done through the ages, why is it that in spite of their presence, these terrible things go on in the world? You see, our criteria are different. We apply the wrong criterion. We think of fulfillment as something which is pleasant. This is a mistake. Fulfillment is neither pleasant nor painful. We, in other words, try to drag God or transcendence down to our level instead of becoming liberated, emptied, and living at that level. We have no conception, and in fact it is impossible to form a conception and have words to express how transcendence works. We can't do it. It's at a level totally beyond human manifestation. But if at any time, by grace if you like, you touch transcendence, you will suddenly know it. Remember that little passage I read out 3 days back? that rather long passage which it was not possible to read right through, there is something of the influence of that there. Transcendence is non-compulsive. God does not interfere with the world. God allows himself to be sacrificed, to be made sacred by suffering on account of the evil of the world. And the effect of that takes place fundamentally in a transcendent sense, in a transcendent nature and world. But it continuously, non-compulsively, but irresistibly draws man to his fulfillment. Eternity can only be manifest in every moment of time. Time is the continuity process. Eternity is the non-continuous, the discontinuous totality embodied in the finite and the particular. But if that embodied infinity in the finite were to try to hasten the movement, there would only be disruption. Just like the energy, the power of the atom, if we happen to be ignorant and not be able to use it in the right way, it just absolutely devastates whole cities. You see? So it's the mercy of God that God lets things grow slowly to their fulfillment. Have you ever planted an acorn and watched for 40 years till it comes to maturity as an oak? Or have you planted an acorn and put it into a greenhouse and hoped to see a wonderful sturdy oak in 4 years? No. Not that way. The great rhythms of life must move in their own sweet way. And it is the same with us, which is not to be treated as an excuse for saying, oh, I can be fully attentive next week. I just want to enjoy a few things now, but I'll be fully attentive and good next week. You know, the sort of almost cosmic jest, St. Augustine in his Confessions says, make me chaste, O God, but not just yet. You see, that we have to take our own decision in the matter. But I hope that this has helped you to understand the significance, the implications of this denudation of the mind. Don't grasp at any of the ideas and so forth. Live in the idea immediately in the moment as it occurs. Live it with intensity, with complete attention, and let the form dissolve away. The creative source and life is within you, and then it will keep on creating unhindered.